Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Kieran Connolly, you're the author of Sam Maguire, The Man and the Cup. You're not only from Dunmanway, you're from the square in Dunmanway, so you couldn't get any more Dunmanway if it was your middle name.
That's right.
And I presume that... So tell us about who and what you are prior to finding out why it is you wrote that book.
All right, I worked as a lecturer in the Dublin Institute of Technology for most of my career, and I retired in 2016, and then I took up my lifetime ambition of writing a book about Sam Maguire, which I did and was published in 2017.
And explain then why that was your life's ambition. I mean, I suppose, you know, you've grown up knowing that the Sam Maguire Cup was named after a man from your locality, so that'll spark an interest, won't it?
But, surprisingly enough, despite the fact that I passed his grave 3 or 4 times a day going to and from school, I wasn't aware of his significance or its importance. And it was only when a fellow came to court, my eldest sister, he was from Carrick and Shannon, Des Cox was his name, and he said, "Margaret Connolly, you never told me that Sam Maguire was from Dunmanway." And he said, if he was from Carrick and Shannon, the whole world would know about it. And literally, that was the first time it ever occurred to me that Dunmanway had such a famous son. And that was about 1971. And that kind of kindled the idea in my mind of eventually writing a book about him.
And do you think he's recognised enough in his home county of Cork as being a Cork man? Do you think there's a pride around the fact that the Sam Maguire Cup is named after a Corkman?
I wouldn't think so, Dave. No, I'd say most people are very surprised when they find out he's from Dunmanway and from Cork. Most people are... ignorant is probably too strong a word, but ignorant is the word, I think, yeah, of his life and his career.
What is there down West Cork way to commemorate Sam Maguire?
Well, Cliff Jeffers, who's from the Reverend Cliff Jeffers, who's the minister in St. Mary's Church, a native of Bandon, a couple of years ago installed what he labelled the Sam Maguire bells in the church and started teaching people to ring the bells. So there's that, and his headstone, obviously. The park, the local GA park, is called the Sam Maguire Park. There was also, in a townland called Derrylahan, Sam Maguire holiday homes, and there's a monument there as well.
Have we a statue anywhere, I wonder?
Oh, statue, I apologise.
Is there? There is.
Statue in the middle of the square right in front
Very
of my
good.
House.
Very good. There you go. Yeah, it's so close you forget. You don't even notice it. Well, do you know what? That actually nicely sums up a little bit of how you started the story.
Yeah.
In that sometimes we don't notice what's right in front of our own faces.
Literally, yeah. That was my case anyway.
And actually, you know, it's almost a wider thing in Ireland that it's only when there's an external... In fact, you know what? It mightn't even be just an Irish thing. It might be a universal world thing whereby it's only when there's an external validation of something that you almost don't even notice how special it is yourself because you're so used to it.
I agree. Yeah, that's a perfect description. Perfect description. It took an outsider to tell me that Dunmanway had a famous son.
Well, let me tell you, my connection to Sam Maguire, my loose connection to Sam Maguire is that back in 2010, when Cork Glass won it,
right.
Red FM, we were in some way, I don't know, where we... connected to Cork GAA at the time, or were we media partners and something or other. But anyway, the boss here at the time said to me, "Listen, they need a DJ for the homecoming." I said, "Well,
right.
I don't really DJ. I'm more of kind of an MC presenter sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my sideline in this media world, you know."
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of presenters on radio would also play music places. Now, I've done it and I can do it, but I don't see myself as a music playing DJ as such.
Yeah.
So I said to the boss, "That's not really me, you know." He says, "Listen, you just need to go down, stick on a few songs, blah, 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 easy breezy, it'll be good for your profile." So I said, "You know what, Grant." So I went down anyway on the day, and you know, being a Louth man originally, I wouldn't be so used to GAA homecomings.
Sad but true.
Neither Sam nor Liam would have been returning to Louth that often.
Sad but true. Dermot O'Brien, 1957, I think, wasn't it?
My old man remembered that indeed.
Oh,
yes,
right.
When Cork had to wear the blue because there was the colour clash.
Right. Yeah.
Louth also were red and white, and they were very much the underdogs, but sadly, from a Cork perspective, they took Sam Maguire back out of Cork's clutches in 57, is right. Mm. But listen, I wouldn't be so used to it anyway. So the stage goes up down opposite City Hall, Parliament Street and South Mall, right at that juncture.
You can
have the crowds down the both ways, looking over towards the bus station and down the Mall towards Finbar's in the distance. And when I got there anyway, they put the DJ decks out like a dais at the front of the stage. Now, I imagined I'd be stuck in the back somewhere, you know, in beside the sound desk, just putting on songs. The next thing, they're like, DJ out front as the, you know, and I'm like, whoa, okay. Right, I'll have to get my head around this. So anyway, I had a, geez, when I think about it, it was one of those People's Republic of Cork hurling shirts where they made the Leonardo da Vinci figure look like a hurler. But it was the closest thing I had to something that looked GAA. And standing out in front, I draped the front of it with a Cork flag anyway. And over the course of the evening, I got more and more into it, you know. And there were more and more bits that I had to announce. So I was coming up with various things. And at one point I was like, you know, the Examiner were live streaming from the old bank building that was opposite, looking down onto the thing. And I was like, ladies and gentlemen, you know, live streaming on the Irish Examiner. And I kind of pointed over, and then I was like, make sure they can hear us in Kerry, you know, and stuff like this anyway. And people were loving that. No, but my moment arrived later in the thing. I'd been told a million times that Sam Maguire would be with us imminently. And there was any number of these delays, right? So anyway, someone comes up to me and they said, right, this is it now for definite. Sam Maguire will be with us in 20 minutes.
Right.
So anyway, I goes, ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention for a moment, please. Sam Maguire will be with us in 20 minutes. Now, I'd given a number of those over the course of the evening, and people were getting impatient and tired and everything else. But in a stroke, it just came to me and I said, we've waited 20 years. We can wait another 20 minutes. And the place erupted and the flags went all over. I swear to God, it was the it was the moment of my life.
Well, that was a wonderful
50,000 odd people. But I came off the stage, and both then and in the days to follow, I met people that knew me when I came down to college, knowing next nor nothing about the GAA, saying to me, we were there going, what the hell's your man from Dundalk doing up there? How did he get in centre stage in such a Cork moment, you know?
Yeah.
And even in the Examiner the next day, there was a big shot of the stage, and there I could see myself in the corner of it, and I was like, how have I ended up? I always knew that Sam Maguire was a Cork man, and that there were various things named about him down below. Liam McCarthy, I kind of, and I did a bit of a Google and found out that he was a Protestant man, which was also interesting to me too.
That's amazing. That's the thing I think people find most surprising.
Is that
he didn't play for the local club, the Donnies, before he went to London.
We're going to get into that now.
Right.
Liam McCarthy, then, I would have done, because I wondered, why would the cup be named after him? What have they done, you know?
I know what you mean, yeah.
And Liam McCarthy, then, I looked and found out that he was from Cork parents. And I thought, both of them are Cork. Then one day I was seeing a girl in Dublin. She lived in Glasnevin, and we were heading from Glasnevin through Phibsborough, and we were heading, I could see Croke Park in the distance, the spaceship stadium that it is now.
Incredible.
And I remember thinking to myself, why is it Croke Park? Who was Croke? So I did a bit of a Google on that, and I found out he was from Cork. Now, whatever about Sam Maguire, I think people know he's a Cork man. They might know that McCarthy had Cork parents and seemingly swore in Michael Collins into the IRB.
Yeah.
But then to find out that Croke was also a born Cork man, I was like, the Holy Trinity of GAA in Ireland, and they're all Cork men. I said, that's a story Cork people need to hear, and that's why I have you on the line.
Oh, that's great. three good reasons for telling people about them. Yeah.
So I know you've written the book about Sam Maguire, and you've done a bit of delving into McCarthy and Croke, and I guess your knowledge would descend in that order.
Okay.
I'm presuming in terms of your expertise.
Yeah.
But let's tease out the Holy Trinity, the GA Holy Trinity of Croke, McCarthy and Maguire, all Corkmen. Would we start with Croke, or would you start with your
special Croke, because he's the earliest in time.
Yes. Okay, so off you go. 1823. Where's Kilbrin? It's out
Ballyclough.
And for those that don't know, where are we going? North, west, east?
North, up near Mallow, is it, Ballyclough?
Yes.
It is, yeah, I think so,
Up the Claw, I think they say.
He was, his father was William Croke, and he was the land agent for the Freeman Estate, which must be up there somewhere. He married a Protestant lady, Isabella Plummer, and That was in the 1820s.
Seemingly she got disowned as a result of marrying a Catholic.
She did indeed.
I mean, if you think about it, like 1823 was possibly before emancipation, was it?
Well, it was 1829 was emancipation. Oh, geez, the Protestant Catholic thing would have been...
Wow.
I mean, in my lifetime, Catholic-Protestant marriages were still frowned on.
Yeah.
Not a mind to say 150 years ago, 200 years ago.
So she got disowned as a result of marrying the Catholic. There must be some story there. It'd be brilliant if someone could delve into that.
That's
but anyway,
true indeed, yeah.
So
yeah.
And then like for her family, like I don't know, was he the only person of the cloth? But to end up an Archbishop of the Catholic Church
incredible,
from a
yeah.
Protestant mother,
and
they must have been.
Several of his siblings ended up as priests and nuns.
There you go. I thought that there was more. Was there about 12 of them or something?
Yeah, five of them, I think, ended up in the clerical garb,
wow.
yeah,
wow.
in one shape or another.
So the plumbers must have been disgusted.
Absolutely.
But there you go. So Thomas Croke.
Qualified as a priest, and he studied in the Irish College in Rome. He was a very brilliant student. He received gold and silver medals, and he he donated those to the famine relief in 1846. He was ordained a priest in May 1847. So he was obviously quite a brilliant student and a brilliant man.
Charleville is seemingly where he was educated before.
That's right, yeah.
Irish
yeah.
College in
yeah.
Paris.
And his first nationalist episode really was in 1848.
Do you think this is true now?
No. Sorry, no, I have a different tale.
Oh, go on.
Himself and another priest offered to take over the editorship of the Nation, the Young Ireland newspaper, after the editor, Gavin Duffy, was arrested.
So he had a nationalist bent to him from
very early on, from very early on indeed, yeah. So he was, the next career move then was president of St. Colman's College in Fermoy in 1858. Returned to be parish priest of Donnerail in 1865. And his next significant event then was the First Vatican Council took place in 1870, which was followed by the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s. He, because of his theological knowledge and excellence, I suppose intellectual excellence, accompanied the Bishop of Cloyne as his advisor to the Vatican Council. He was then appointed, which is an extraordinary thing, Bishop of Auckland in New Zealand in 1870. Served for 4 years and then returned to Ireland. But again, interestingly, on his way through the United States, coming back to Ireland, he went to visit John Devoy, who was a leading Fenian, who had been in jail and has later immigrated to America, and discussed the Irish national struggle with him, and said he agreed with the national struggle, but he didn't agree with armed struggle because he thought there was little hope of beating, I suppose, the power of the empire, really, which I suppose in one sense was a sensible approach certainly by a clergyman, I suppose, yeah. Mm. So then, in 1875, we're getting to the GA story again.
Well, you just wonder if there's a suggestion that Croke fought on the barricades in Paris during the 1848 French Revolution, which was a Europe-wide series of protests,
right,
which was
really
about human rights and citizens and democracy
and
wresting
the
power from the aristocracy.
Yeah,
and from from the royal elite, and bringing it back to the people as such.
Yeah,
so you'd
yeah.
wonder if that was true. It's the Irish radical William O'Brien who has said that Croke
right.
fought on the barricades.
Yeah.
And that's 1848. And you're saying, when was he? He was ordained in 1847, so he'd have been a priest at the time. You just wonder, was he on the barricades fighting for the people in Paris at that time? And did that influence?
Because he certainly was very radical and got into trouble with the Vatican several times because of his views on Irish politics and his opposition to the British government in Ireland. So he was certainly, in terms of Irish nationalism, perhaps not, supporting the violent struggle, but certainly supported the struggle.
So I suppose like the Land League
because he was Archbishop of Cashel, and during the Land League period, 1879 to 1882, he was known as the Land League Archbishop. And it suggested that he had, as early as 1848 or 1849, advocated the tactics of the Land League of organizing the tenant farmers to fight the landlords, because he'd been influenced by a man called James Fenton Lawler, who was a leading revolutionary in 1848. So he was ahead of his time. And as I said, he got into trouble with the Vatican. And the papal legate said to the Vatican, he is one of the most ardent nationalists and a bitter enemy of the British government.
And you wonder why Croke Park got named after him. I don't know if that's the answer for it as such, but certainly it his colours are fairly pegged to the mast.
Very early in his life, I'd say. Mm. Very early in his life. Oh, God, yes. And I was going to say, like as I said, the Pope, or the Vatican at the time, regarded him with suspicion, but Paul Cullen, who was the Cardinal of Ireland, or the Primate of All Ireland at the time, was a very good friend of Croke's. And I suppose, in a sense, protected him from the Vatican's wrath, if you want to put it like that. So then, GA was formed in November the 1st, 1884, and he was asked by Morris Davin to be the patron of the organisation, to which he readily agreed.
I suppose he was the Archbishop of Cashel.
Archbishop of Cashel, I apologise, yeah.
And it was Cashel. And it was Thurles where...
Thurles was where the GA was found.
And the Victoria Hotel on Patrick Street was the second meeting of the GAA.
But he, I think the GAA founder said that his patronage was hugely important in the early years of the organisation to make it respectable for Catholics to be involved in the organisation. So he was a powerful influence from that perspective as well. The GA was recognised by all sides as a potentially influential organisation. And in the 1887 convention, the IRB, Irish Republican Brotherhood, also known as the Fenians, attempted to take over the GAA. And they were opposed by Charles Stewart Parnell party, who also wanted to take over the GAA. So there was a split, which is, as Brendan Behan said, is the first thing on the agenda of any organisation, any Irish organisation, is the split. So 3 years after 1884, there was a split.
But it is interesting that already so early on in the GAA's history that there was a battle, there was a recognition of its...
The
potential...
That they were so... I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. They were so intelligent that they could see...
The role it could play in Irish society.
In Irish life and Irish politics. Mm.
So Parnell, of course, is the parliamentary side and the IRB is the revolutionary side.
Violent
revolution.
So in 1888, then Croke brought the two sides together and Morris Davin was re-elected president. So he's very important then in preserving or starting the GAA and then preserving it once it had started. And as I said, he was a very prominent Land Leaguer and public supporter of the Land League. Also a supporter of Parnell and the struggle for Home Rule that that his party was conducting in the English Parliament. Mm-hmm. But then when the Parnell split took place, he disowned Parnell, as he probably had to really, because Parnell was involved in a divorce case. And at the time, divorce was scandalous and beyond the pale completely. And certainly for a churchman, he could not continue to support somebody who was causing scandal in his words, or not in his words, but in the words of the church, that he was causing scandal. And so he said he disowned Parnell. He had a statue of Parnell in his in his house, and he threw the statue out.
Goodness. Threw him on his head.
That's right.
Dear.
Oh, yeah. But so he, his next involvement then was he presented, in 1896, he presented the GAA with two Croke Cups for hurling and football. And they are very interesting because they seem to have disappeared. They were last played for in 1916, and my research says that counties at the time, clubs represented counties at the time, and clubs were reluctant to hand back the cups, and the cups may simply have not been returned to the GAA headquarters. And in 1970, an antique dealer in Cork found pieces of one of the Croke cups, which I think now is in the GAA Museum in Croke Park. So, very important in the GAA and in the national struggle as well, as I pointed out there. So, he died in 1902, long before the others were born. Well, 1902, yeah. So, long before Maguire was born, anyway.
Well, before we slide into the other two, I suppose most people know Croke Park was Jones's Road before was named Croke Park. And 1902 is when Thomas Croke, Archbishop Thomas Croke, the Bishop of Cashel, for whom, by the way, it's why does it still happen? Does the bishop still throw the ball in for the?
I don't think
that still happens. But it in honour of Croke, his successors as Archbishop of Cashel and Emily traditionally are asked to throw in the ball at the minor Gaelic football and All Ireland hurling finals. So maybe
the GAA organised in 1913. They organised a Croke Memorial Competition, and the final was held in March 1913. Kerry beat Lowe's. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Jesus, I'm just glad we were there.
And they raised £3,500 from the Croke Memorial Competition, and they decided to buy Jones's Road
outright
from a man called Frank Dineen from Ballylanders in Limerick.
Right,
was a journalist who had bought it 3 or 4 years before. So the official name starting was the Croke Memorial Park.
So from 1913. So he was already dead over a decade.
Oh God, yes.
But he'd been a towering figure. He'd been the patron of the GAA from its foundation.
Yeah.
He'd presented,
helped heal the split, which could have destroyed the organisation. Obviously, if there were two competing versions of the GAA,
and his and his imprimatur gave it a respectability at a time when it needed it.
I think very important. Yeah,
donated the cups, and so then. 1913, they have that Croke Memorial game, which raises the money, which buys the ground, and they name
that's
it after
right,
him. Okay. The next time, and let's hope it's sooner rather than later, the next time the rebels descend en masse in the red and white to Croke Park, you can look at it in the distance and you'll know why it's named after a Corkman from Kilbrin, Archbishop Thomas Croke. Okay. So now, I suppose, let's go to McCarthy, will we?
Yeah. Very interesting, because his parents were from Ballygarvan in County Cork. Owen McCarthy married Bridget Dineen. They were native Irish speakers. They were evicted from their farm in 1851.
Well, that's interesting. I meant to mention that with Archbishop Croke, in that he'd have, you know, so he would have been made a priest. What do you call it? What is it when someone's made a priest?
Ordained.
Thank you. That's the word. Ordained a priest in 1847. So just
1847. Yeah.
So that's actually mid famine. Now that I think of it. Because
he donated money, his gold medal and his silver medal to famine relief.
Ah, yes. Studied.
And when O'Connell died, which I forgot to mention there as we're going through, O'Connell died in 1847, I think.
Yes.
He celebrated a mass in Rome for O'Connell's soul.
Right.
So he was very involved in that struggle as well.
Yes, you did mention that, but we did pass over it, so let's repeat it. Studied in the Irish College in Rome, received gold and silver medals, presumably for excellence, and donated them for famine relief in 1846. Yeah. Ordained the following year.
Yeah.
And now let's bring it back to McCarthy, whose parents were evicted just at... And, you know, many of us will have watched the two-part famine documentary.
The Hunger, great programmes.
While in school you learned that it was 1845 to 1850, they spoke about how it lingered, its effects. It was seven or eight years. So into the early 1850s, the famine was absolutely still extant.
And that's when
his parents were those who suffered as a result of the conditions around the time
his
of the
father
famine.
Was known as Coppel, the Irish word for horse, because he was a big, strong man. And McCarthy himself was a very big man as well. So he took after his father, they say, in that particular regard.
So did they head for London after they were evicted?
They did, yeah. And what's very important in that story then is that as they were being evicted, his mother, Bridget, took a statue of a Celtic loving cup and hid it in her cloak or whatever from the bailiffs, and she took that to London with them, and she kept that on her mantelpiece all her life, the loving cup, which comes back later when we talk about the creation of the McCarthy Cup.
Okay. So what do we know about McCarthy in London? And
so then he started off as a blacksmith hammerman, which was that the blacksmith would indicate with a hammer or a piece of metal where the hammerman was to hit the metal on the anvil, which would have made him fairly strong if he wasn't big to begin with. Mm. Later worked as a signal fitter, which is still in occupation on the railways in London. So then, luckily for him, he was always very, very interested in Gaelic sports and played hurling. Hurling was his favourite sport. And he played hurling on Clapham Common in London. And according to the excellent book by Sean Meaney, which is called Our Name is on the Cup, which is about McCarthy and Maguire, while he was playing hurling in Clapham Common, he saw this very attractive young lady, and she said to him, "What's that game you're playing? I've never seen anybody play that before." And they got to talk, and then her name was Alice Padbury, and her father was a cardboard box manufacturer and fancy box manufacturer. They got together and married, and so he married Alice Padbury in 1875. He began to work for the Padbury Company, but fell out with his father-in-law, which is not unusual, I suppose. It can be hard to work for your father-in-law. And he moved to his own premises, which he called St. Bridget's, in memory of his mother, who was named Bridget the name. He was very successful as a businessman, and despite stories to the contrary, the business prospered and continued to prosper and is still in operation today, run by his great-grandson.
Well, when we mentioned that he was buried in an unmarked grave, we'll question how that happened, because you almost presume that he didn't have the money for it. But
I know, that's the common story on the web, that he was a pauper and buried in a pauper's grave.
Interesting.
But as I said, the firm is still in operation. His great-grandson, is currently running the firm.
Well, we all know families can go funny, so who knows? Maybe he was sidelined out of it on some level or other. Maybe he was sidelined out of it on some level or other.
I don't know what happened to him. We don't know.
Was he a drinker?
He was teetotal.
Really?
Yeah, his father was a drinker.
Because that was a big thing at the time, wasn't it? Also, the abstinence movement.
His father was a drinker and McCarthy was teetotal.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which was...
Well, you can imagine if you were evicted from your home in Ballygarvan during the famine.
Yeah, and then to end up in the biggest city in the world and,
You might have needed a bit of drink along the way.
It hard to make a living.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be easy, no. Wouldn't be easy at all.
And similarly, working for the father-in-law, Mr. Padbury, his Irish leanings, if he worked for him initially, it can't have been a huge thing, but activities going forward would have become more and more revolved around Irish affairs and Irish revolutionary affairs. Wasn't an easy thing for his English
part,
family.
Yeah. But as I said, from the very start, he was very interested in Gaelic games and was a precursor of the GAA, if you want to put it like that. Mm. So the London County Board was formed in 1896, and he became the first treasurer. And it's recorded that the sum total of the treasury was 4 shillings in old money, which is, I suppose, I don't know, 50p or something in Northern 50 cents. But he, as a wealthy man, he was very, very generous to the GAA and to Irish people who were in need of assistance, and was very good at donating medals and cups to various clubs and various competitions. He moved to be president or chairperson in 1898. He held that position until 1907, and he was followed in that position by Sam Maguire. Mm. And during those years of the early 1900s, up to 1912 or thereabouts, himself and Maguire rotated the jobs of chairperson and secretary.
Interesting.
Between each other.
So like the way McCurtain and McSweeney were hand in glove
exactly.
here in Cork politically,
exactly,
Maguire
good.
And McCarthy were in the London County Board.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And very obviously very good friends and very close working partners and presumably sharing. Of course they did. They shared similar national ideals, as we call them.
Yes.
So the GAA became, the GAA then allowed London to become a province of the GAA in 1901, which allowed London then to participate in the All-Ireland final. And the way the GAA organised that was that the 32 counties played, produced a champion, and then in what they call the away final, the London team played the winners of the 32 county competition. McCarthy became the secretary stroke treasurer of the London of the English Council and helped to set up the Lancashire County Board. So then in 1900, he decided he'd try his hand at politics.
So this is 47 years of age. And just,
that's right.
So he's 22 when he marries.
Yeah.
And it's 1896, so what's that? That's 43 yeah, when he's
so
the
he's,
treasurer.
He's 1900 now, so he's what? 47?
Yeah.
47, yeah. He was elected as an independent councillor. And this is a good one as well. He was elected for Peckham. Peckham number 7 ward. And of course, Peckham is where Del Boy and the other lads lived in Nelson Mandela House.
That's right.
He was known as Fighting Mac.
Fighting Mac, the couple Fighting Mac.
That's right. He was a big man, just like his father, as I said. And he was known as, he held the seat for 12 years and then decided that...
I'm guessing he was no shrinking violet.
Oh, God, no, he wasn't. from the records, he was quite vociferous on the corporation, on the county corporation, and sat on many committees and was very helpful. I suppose, like modern politicians, he was very good at trying to help people to navigate their way through the bureaucracy and the regulations of the Victorian civil service, trying to get their rights, I suppose you'd say. Yeah.
And meantime, he's also a member of secret societies, bent on
a
revolution.
Of the Irish Volunteers, when they were formed,
yeah.
The IRB, and then the vice president of the London Gaelic League.
So he's straddling many.
His connection
things.
Then, his next connection to Maguire, is he recruited Maguire into the IRB in 1902.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, again, which is an echo going back of modern times, the rule against playing foreign games was introduced in the 1900s, and there was a split in the London GAA on the issue of the foreign rules. McCarthy and Maguire supported the ban on people playing foreign rules, and there was a separate... board created with McCarthy and Maguire in charge.
Well, we'll come back to Maguire, but he went for London. When did he head for London?
1897.
So he would have been a 20-year-old man.
Exactly, when he went to London, 20
so 1897.
Years. 1897.
So he wasn't there that long when he was up to his neck in all of the politics.
No,
maybe he was, sort of a bit of a bruiser for McCarthy or support for McCarthy, who would have been longer in the tooth at that point.
That's right. Oh, McCarthy was bigger and older and strong, more imposing, yeah.
So no foreign games if you're going to be part of London GAA. Jeez, it was quite militant even then, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, according to McCarthy and Maguire, anyway.
Wow. Straight, like, because whatever, you can understand it in Ireland when, there was the competition over other sports, to be smack bang in the middle of London and say you won't
and
play.
I should say there, Michael Collins also sided with them. His club also voted in favour of the ban on people playing foreign games. So McCarthy, Maguire and Collins were together at that point.
Wow.
In the London County Board of the GAA and in the Irish Republican Brotherhood.
Goodness
and
me.
In the Gaelic League.
Well, there we go, because Maguire seemingly swore in Collins.
Oh, he did, yeah.
So, I mean,
there's a direct link.
The Cork Mafia, that's what we've unearthed here. Huh?
Because there's a historian, what's his name? Roy Foster, he wrote a book called Vivid Faces about this period. And he said you could draw a direct line of subversion from West Cork to London. With a stream of people like Collins and Maguire who immigrated to London and helped to undermine the Empire's control over Ireland.
Goodness me.
So So you could see a graph, almost a visual image, of a path being beaten from Cork over to London of future leaders of the Republican movement and the Gaelic Athletic Association. So he was a great supporter of Padraig Pearse, and subsequently founded, later on in the 20s, I think, founded a club called the Pearse Brothers. He supported him financially when he started his school, St. Enda's in Rathfarnham, in 1908, and he sent his son Eugene there as a boarder. And Eugene attended the meeting in the rotunda to form the Irish Volunteers as the delegate or one of the representatives for London. Again, in his book, Sean Meaney suggests that he may have helped to finance the Howth gun running in July 1914 when the Volunteers matched the gun running at Larne carried out by the Ulster Volunteers 2 years before. And then in 1916, there was a meeting of the Volunteers in London to decide what to do about the forthcoming rebellion in Ireland. And Michael Collins asked McCarthy for his advice. And McCarthy says, supposedly, if you come from Clonakilty, it is obvious where you must go. So Collins went back to Dublin, took part in the rising. And because most of the leaders of the IRB died in 1916 or were executed, and Collins took over the IRB, and that created a big link then between him, McCarthy and Maguire in the years of the War of Independence. It is also suggested, again by Sean Meaney in that wonderful book, that De Valera was arrested, I think it was after what was called the German Plot, where Sinn Féin was supposed to be intriguing for the Germans, whom the British were fighting, and was held in Lincoln Jail. He was broken out of Lincoln Jail, and it is suggested that McCarthy paid for the transport of the Volunteers from London to Lincoln to help Dev escape. So then in March 1919, Sinn Féin set up the Irish Self-Determination League, and he formed a branch in Peckham of the Irish Self-Determination League. Then we come to his cup. The Dáil loan, Michael Collins was Minister for Finance in the Dáil government of 1919, and they launched an appeal to the Irish people and the Irish people all over the world to raise £250,000 for the Dáil operation, the IRA's operations. He became treasurer of the London Committee, and he donated £50, which would be £2,600 in €2,800 in 2019. So when the Dáil loan was repaid, it was at a meeting of the Brothers Pearse Club, which he had helped to form. It was decided that when the loan was repaid, McCarthy would give the £50 to the GAA to buy a cup in his name. And the design he chose, going back to my very first point about McCarthy, was the Gaelic Loving Cup, because that had been prominent in his youth and his adult, I suppose, when he was at home, that it was on the mantelpiece, and I'm sure his mother frequently reminded him of the significance of the Loving Cup to the family. So it was made by Edward Johnson Jewellers in Grafton Street, and presented to the GAA in 1922. The cup was first won by Limerick in 1923, which is a nice echo of what happened last Sunday. And this was actually for the 1921 championship, because in those years, it was often the case that finals were played years after the matches leading to the final had been played. Sorry. Right. So the Limerick captain, Bob McConkey, was the first captain to lift the McCarthy Cup, because, like the Sam Maguire Cup, it got some battering when it went around the counties. It was decided to retire the cup in 1991. The last man to receive it, the first McCarthy Cup was Declan Carr Tipperary, and the first man to receive the new McCarthy Cup was Liam Finlay of Kilkenny. During the Civil War, both Maguire and McCarthy sided with Michael Collins in the split in the IRA in Sinn Féin in that terrible period, and that meant that McCarthy was sidelined from his GAA activities during that period. So he died, we'll come to the interesting bit then about his death and his burial and all that. He died on September the 28th. His wife died very soon after, within a week or 2 weeks. And Sean Meaney's mother remembers being in the house, the McCarthy house, where McCarthy himself was dying in one room, and his wife was so unwell that she couldn't go to see him, even though she was in another room in the house. So then he was buried in a regular grave, which was recorded as a regular burial, but the grave wasn't marked. There was no headstone put up.
Interesting.
Which is a tale in itself, which we have, I have yet to find a rational explanation for. Mm. There is a suggestion that there was contention about the will between the children, and that might have led to some, I don't know, bitterness or competition or whatever.
Goodness me.
But anyway, it wasn't until Sean Meaney dug up the facts about the burial that in 1996 he was able to persuade the GAA to raise a headstone to McCarthy in the grave in Dulwich, where the headstone is. And in May 2000, he got the GAA to put a monument there as well to Liam McCarthy. So, as I said at the beginning, the firm continues in operation, but there's no explanation of why the grave was left unmarked for so many years.
But it is now.
It is now, which is due to the man, Sean Meaney, as I mentioned before, and his book, Our Name is on the Cup, because he's the one who did the detective work and contacted descendants of McCarthy, found the grave registration number, visited the graveyard, identified the grave, and then persisted with trying to get somebody to formally recognise the grave. So he was introduced to him.
Mm.
So credit
to him, because I think that's a worthy thing to do.
I said it to him an email today. I said, you deserve great credit for your interest and your persistence, because otherwise the grave would still be unmarked, which would be a terrible tragedy and a disgrace, really.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah, a shame,
so,
for sure.
So he told me that McCarthy's ancestors, McCarthy's grandchildren, continue to come to the All-Ireland final every year. And so that's a good thing that they get the tickets, and bring quite a group of people with them, I think, to the All-Ireland hurling final.
Mm-hmm.
So we've hopefully demolished one myth anyway, that the poor man was a pauper buried in a pauper's grave.
Yes. Well, we have two of the triumvirate, the GAA, the Cork GAA Holy Trinity. I don't know how to quite phrase it correctly.
Right, yeah.
But we have Croke and we have McCarthy. The younger of them all is the man you know best, because you've written the book. Let's remind people, Kieran Connolly, Sam Maguire, The Man in the Cup, available online.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's
a good read, is it, Kieran?
Oh, gee. Of course it is.
So go on, give us.
Right, so he was born in March, March 11th, 1877, just a few miles north of Dunmanway, in a townland called Malabracca. His parents farmed there, and I think the unique thing about them and him is that they were members of the Church of Ireland, and at the time, about 12% of the population of Dunmanway were members of Church of Ireland, and it continues to have quite a high percentage of members of that church in the area.
And there's certainly no shortage of Kingstons in West Cork.
That's right,
sure.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Maguire feels to me like more of a northern name than a Cork name.
I checked that out at the time, and I think it was the 1901 census, I found that there was a fair distribution of Maguires from one border of Cork over near Waterford to the other border near Kerry.
So all over.
And just as an aside, the man who started the Cork Examiner, his name was Maguire.
That's right. Yes, so. Correct, yes. I think he was a member of Parliament, wasn't he?
Yeah, so they were... we always think of Maguire up in Fermanagh, Fermanagh, yeah. I think.
But they were all over. Mala Bracha, you were saying, Oscuelga, or the roots of it is bad ground, is it?
It is, yeah, land of the little hillocks. So they had only a few fertile acres, and the land in the next townland was valued at £1 an acre more, and most of the land now is under forestry, which is a sign like that the land isn't very productive in itself. And at that site now, as I said, there's a memorial to Sam Maguire, and the local man Pat Spillane and his family have built the Sam Maguire Memorial Holiday Cottages. And it's a lovely location, beautiful place. Perhaps not the easiest place to make a living, but certainly very good to look at. So he attended the local model school then. And at the time, Irish history wasn't taught. The Irish language wasn't taught. So Maguire's formation, I think, came from... His parents decided that he would attend a school in... Ardfield, just south of Clannachilty, run by a man called Master Madden. And this school was known as the University of the Mountain because Ardfield, the people from Ardfield, were called the people of the mountain. And it specialised in... It was a grind school, which specialised in preparing students for the English Civil Service and the English Post Office. And they were very good jobs to have at the time when there were very few jobs in Ireland because there was, as we would say in modern times, they were permanent and pensionable. And in Dublin, Michael Cusack, the founder of the GAA, also ran a similar school on a private basis and made quite a lot of money out of running that grind school in Dublin. So Maguire stayed with his uncle, who was the coachman for Coachman for Castle Freak House. So he stayed with him while he was studying in Ardfield. He was appointed as a sorter in the Mount Pleasant office in November 1897. And his brothers John and Richard followed his tracks and also worked in the postal service in London. In 1895, he helped form the London Hibernian Club, which was his club for the remainder of his time in London. And that was made up mainly of postal workers. And as I said, he was president in 1907 when McCarthy stepped down. He was president again and he was president of Clint until 1909 when McCarthy took over again. So
that sounds like a Vladimir Putin-like move. Come here to me. I'm going to step down for a couple of years till the coast is clear. Then you get out of the way and I'll be back on top again. It can't be me the whole way through. We have to make Now, who knows? Who knows? But
the point is, which is obvious, is they were obviously very close.
Yes.
And trusted each other.
Yes, implicitly.
Do the right thing, as the fellow would say.
Yes.
So then, prefiguring Maguire's later life, his brother Richard died from TB in July 1912. And his brother John died from the same disease in November 13. So it's prefigured, as I said, what happened to poor Sam in the end. So his GAA career then was, as I said, London were allowed to play in what they called the away final. And Sam played in four finals, 1900, 1901, 1902 and 1903.
Goodness.
London continued to play in the away final until I think 1908, when the away final was eliminated from the GAA calendar.
You'd wonder. So the winner of the 32 counties played London, probably because of the significance of London as a place in the world.
And I think the GAA wanted to spread.
Yes.
Its influence in London, and that was a good way to do it. Then was to
publicity.
They recognised it as a province of London, as a province of Ireland, which was lovely.
Goodness me, yeah.
Ireland declared that London was a province.
So, it was a bit of a reversal.
That's
Right. We're going to claim you. How do you feel about that?
Oh, good Lord.
So he plays in a few, well, do you call them All-Ireland finals? I mean, I guess you'd...
Well, they were called away finals.
They were called away finals, okay.
The problem was that London, a bit like, not being smart nor being sarcastic about London, but a bit like London in modern times, they weren't able to compete with the home teams at all.
Yes.
And certainly not the All-Ireland winners from the 32 counties.
You'd imagine.
So the scores were always very one-sided.
Yeah.
And I suspect but that it was might probably be a bit of a, the reason as well.
It was probably a bit of a jolly, though, for the winners. It was, it was probably half the, you know, lads, win the cup and we're over to London for an owl weekend that we won't...
No, London came to Dublin.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I should say there, you know, we nearly skipped over this, the first game played in the Athletic Grounds in 1904 was that away final in which Sam Maguire played.
And when you say the Athletic Grounds, do you mean Jones's Park. Road? Oh, in Cork, as in
the Grounds in Cork.
Yes, the original Parky Cueve.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Parky Cueve, yeah.
So the first game in the Athletic Grounds, Sam Maguire played in it.
Was London versus the All-Ireland champions, whoever they were, I can't remember. But what's important is that Sam Maguire played in that first game.
Wow, he must have been very proud of that. His family must have been there.
Oh, yeah. And they talked about, they got a hammering anyway, I'd have to look that up again. But they had... they had to travel by ferry and they had to sleep on deck the night before. And it was pointed out that that was perhaps not the best preparation for a match.
Yes, I can imagine.
So that was the 1902 final, which was played in 1904. And they were invited by the Lord Mayor to a dinner, but they refused to go because members of the police and the armed forces would be present. They were serious men.
Yes, yes. with probably stories to hide.
Good point, yeah. So as I mentioned then, in 1902 he was recruited by Liam McCarthy into the IRB. And 7 years later he recruited Michael Collins into the IRB. When Collins went to fight in 1916, Maguire was advised by the volunteer leadership to stay in London and stay in his job because that could be of great significance in the future struggle. So then his he became, Collins, as I said earlier, became leader of the IRB after 1916, and Maguire became his main man in London. Anybody Collins sent to London was told, contact Maguire, that he was the leading man. And his activities then, because he worked in the post office, he was able to organise a very efficient interception service, intercepting military posts going from London to Dublin or any other part of Ireland, copy the material and give it to Collins in Dublin. He had a very, very efficient postal service himself.
I'd say he did.
Yeah, getting messages to Collins and getting replies through men on the ferries. He had men on the sorting carriages and the trains carrying the mail, and they would identify the military communications. He was in charge of an enormous, well, very big anyway, arms smuggling operation. And this involved, because getting guns is never an easy thing to do, and it involves you in all sorts of nefarious people and places. And in the book, there are some very funny stories about the people and places they met, because they had to involve themselves sometimes with criminals or semi-criminals to get arms. They also proposed what the Provisional IRA would later call spectaculars. And one of these was that the British Army or the British government was proposing to introduce conscription into the Army in Ireland in 1918. And they decided that if the British government did this, they would go into the Parliament when the Act was being passed and shoot the British captain.
Jesus.
Wow. So, they were willing to be daring, and they were told that the possibility of escaping was almost nil. Then, when Terence McSweeney was on hunger strike, they had a plan to kidnap members of the British cabinet to hold him hostage for McSweeney's life or for his release. But also that was, what would you say, that wasn't carried out because they did carry out surveillance of the members of the British Cabinet in preparation for these operations. And they reported that they were able to find very interesting facts about the private lives.
I'm sure they were. Nothing has changed. Wow. And I'm just looking, McCarthy's still alive, so he might not be necessarily involved, but he knows about all of this.
Oh, God, he does, yeah. Mm. Oh, jeez, he does, yeah. So they also conducted arson attacks because the auxiliaries were burning houses and creameries and Sinn Féin offices in Ireland, and they obviously burned Cork City. Mm-hmm. So Maguire and the IRA in England and London carried out arson attacks, which caused panic and fear. And at one point, there were barricades in Downing Street following one of their attacks in London. And a very interesting connection then to West Cork is that there was an officer in the Essex Regiment in Bandon called Major Percival. And Tom Barry described him as one of the most bitter enemies of Ireland. And Barry and the column tried several times to kill Percival. So then Maguire learned that Percival was coming to England on holidays, and Collins set up an assassination team who were waiting at a London station for Percival to get off the train, when suddenly across the street they saw Sam Maguire frantically waving his hands. He had been informed by one of his informers in the police that the operation had been tumbled and that the police were on their way to arrest the IRA group. So very, very, very significant to Michael Collins, hugely significant in the War of Independence in every possible way. He sided again, as I said earlier, with Michael Collins in the Civil War, and that, I'm sure, sidelined him in the GAA as well. So his friend from Bandon had become Secretary of the Department of Post and Telegraphs in Dublin, and he offered Sam a job in the post office. Sam returned to the Irish post office in 1923 and took up his job there. In 1924, following the end of the Irish Civil War, the Free State government found itself with an army, I think, of 55,000 men. By contrast, our modern army is about 9,000 men, I think. And they couldn't afford it, and they had no need for such a large army. So they had to demobilise the army. The problem was, if you were demobilised, there were no jobs anywhere. There was contention over who was going to be demobilised and who was going to be kept on. So some officers staged what was called the Army Mutiny early in 1924. Maguire was associated with this mutiny, but he didn't lose his job at that point. In December 1924, he was dismissed from his job because Kevin O'Higgins, the Minister for Justice, suggested he was involved in a second attempt to create a mutiny, this time involving ordinary soldiers, sergeants and corporals. Previously had been officers who were involved in the mutiny. And Maguire was dismissed from his job, never given a hearing, never allowed to see the evidence, because O'Higgins said it would lead to the deaths of witnesses if the evidence was revealed. So they gave him, I think, a sum of £100, let him go without a pension, and he just then returned to Dunmanway. And on the 6th of February 1927, just before, I think, his 50th birthday, he died of TB just before his 50th birthday in his home in Malabraca on the 6th of February 1927.
In the family home.
So he died from TB as well.
In the family home, Kieran, yeah?
Yeah, Malabraca, the family home.
So did that stay in the family? It's not?
Indeed, yeah. Molly, his last sister, Mary, or Molly as they called her, was living there up to the 1960s. And she was in a very bad way, as you can imagine, an old woman living on her own. And the local man, Dick Neal, organised for her to get a house in town. So she ended up living in Dunmanway. My older brother, remembers doing messages for her, as we used to say at the time. So she probably died. I can't remember when she died now, but she might have died in the 1960s, I suppose. So there are no... The frightening thing is that there were seven children, I think, and there are no direct descendants, which is amazing.
Yeah. You'd wonder, you can have TB for a while, can't you, if he dies?
Absolutely, yeah. February 27th. He could have had it for a while.
He could have had it through that period of the army mutiny and the like.
Yeah.
So that's a murky end.
Oh, it's terrible. general.
How involved, like, where does, from the post office to the officers in the Irish Army, maybe they're just people he knows, or maybe it's...
They would have been IRA men.
Ah.
And so they would have been, a lot of them were...
So he'd have known them well.
A lot of them were Collins's men, and would have been very close to Collins, and Maguire would have known them very well.
Interesting.
No, he would, yeah. The Free State Army, would the officers would have been, many of them would have been Collins's men.
Hmm.
And what the government then decided to do was that there were a lot of ex-British soldiers, which annoyed these men intensely, were being kept on, and IRA men were being demobilised. So they objected strenuously to that happening.
Yeah, I can understand
and why. It is no regard that it was very significant that eventually the army accepted the government's decision. And as we know, our Irish Army has never been involved in politics or anything like that ever since.
Mm.
Because in many other countries in the world, the army does get involved in politics. So that's regarded as a very significant point in Irish history, where the Irish Army could have maybe had a coup d'etat or something like that, or overthrew the government.
Yeah.
So then, when he died, a group of very prominent people from the IRB and from the GAA decided that they would form a committee to raise funds for a cup in his memory, which I think is a tribute to his significance, that these were the leading members of the IRB, many of them, again, close associates of Connell's, and members of the GAA in Dublin and London, all felt that he deserved recognition, and they put together the money, £300, €20,731 in current money in 2019, I apologise. So the design was based on the Arda Chalice, which was found near Arda in Limerick. And that was an old chalice, design of chalice, which had two handles, as you know from looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And Fintan O'Toole points out that we regard the Sam Maguire Cup as the holy grail of Gaelic football. And he suggests that the design, that there was a monk called Alcuin who came back from the Holy Land way back around the year 900 or 1000.
Mm.
And what he described was the chalice used by Jesus at the Last Supper.
Mm.
And it turns out that the Arda chalice is based on that design. So it might literally be the Holy Grail.
Very good.
Yeah,
very good. We'll have the Templars and the Rosicrucians
right.
and the whole lot turning up.
Jesus,
to,
I forgot that.
Turning up to Croke Park, they'd be like, "What? Hang on, we're
so
taking
the cup
that."
Was retired in 1988.
That is a fabulous story, though. You know, when you link it to that there's at least some story that exists of a monk coming back from the Holy Land with the design of a chalice.
Yeah, yeah.
The
Holy Grail was
which the Arda chalice is modelled. After which,
exactly, yeah.
You know, the Sam Maguire Cup, the original Cup, at least made by Staunton and Staunton.
Staunton and Staunton. I was just going to say that the cup was retired in 1988, again, just like McCarthy, because it was getting damaged. And Meath were the last to win it and the first to win the replacement, which the GAA called Sam Og.
Now, let me have a think, because I did a podcast on the double with Adrian earlier this year, and there was one of those finals that Meath won before Cork bet them for the double in 1990.
Yeah.
That there was a lot of bitterness over that Cork should have won it. Was it the 88 one or was it the 89 one?
Might be, Your knowledge of Jay is better than mine.
Yeah, we won't know now. There you go. It's one or the other. So there you go. There's the story of the three Cork characters. The Holy Trinity of the GAA, all Corkmen. Croke from Kilbrin in Ballyclaw. McCarthy, born from Ballygarvan parents in London.
That's right.
And Maguire from Malabracha, outside Dunmanway, in the heart of West Cork.
Mm.
Mad. There we go. Well, now we have it. I always kind of wanted to know the story of the three of them. And I knew more about the Maguire one, a bit more about McCarthy, less so about Croke.
Yeah.
Parky Queeve is named after a GAA administrator who when you told me the story about Maguire playing in the athletic grounds in the first game there, I did a bit of a Google while you were talking. Now, I'm still listening, don't worry. But I found something interesting on that.
Yeah.
On the Cork GAA website about it. So September 11th, 1904. Tower, great occasion for the association, to coincide with the official opening of the newly constructed Cork Athletic Grounds. The 1902 All-Ireland Finals were played there, and as you mentioned, these finals will be played later. So in 1904 was the 1902.
1923, I think, was the first time they were played in the calendar year.
Wow. The grounds on the site of Páirc Uí Chaoimh were formally opened by Lord Mayor Augustine Roach in a brief ceremony. Over 20,000 spectators turned up. There were not enough turnstiles to get them in for the first match. The cheering of the crowd inside provoked large numbers into climbing over the corrugated iron surrounds, which were damaged in the process. Jeez. There were two refreshment rooms inside the grounds. One of these collapsed from the weight of people who climbed... What are you laughing for? These are bad stories. From the weight of people who climbed onto the roof. Fortunately, no one was injured. The games themselves are one-sided. Do we know which of the sports Maguire played? Was it football?
Football.
Okay, so here we go. We have it now. The games themselves were one-sided. Dungourney easily defeated London in the hurling final.
Yeah.
While Bray Emmetts, representing Dublin, defeated London Irish 2-8-1-2 in the football.
Yeah, very significant. Because at the time... counties were represented by club champions.
Yes. Musical
the club, the club champions could pick people from other clubs in that county.
Oh, right. Interesting.
So even when Maguire's team didn't win the London Championship, Maguire was frequently selected on the London team.
I see.
Yeah.
Musical entertainment, you may be interested to hear, provided by the Barrack Street and Butter Exchange bands.
Oh, good Lord.
Yep. There's no getting away from them in Cork. They'll be there. The Barracka. Barracka and the Buttera. And a band from Middleton too. So there we go. Wow. Mad. Brilliant. I'm delighted with that, Kieran Connolly.
Thank you very much.
So that is it. That's Croke, McCarthy and Maguire. I'm very grateful to you, Kieran Connolly.
I enjoyed that.
Author of Sam Maguire, The Man and the Cup. Well worth a read. Did you play football yourself? Doheny's is your home club. Hang on, let me give the credit now because I got onto someone in Doheny's. That's how I tracked you down. Daniel O'Donovan, thank you, sir. And I said to him, let me know if I can ever help on Red FM at all. And he says, I might take you up on your offer sometime. Fair play to you, Daniel O'Donovan. You'll be more than welcome. And grateful to you too.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Gura mila mila mahagat, Kieran Connolly. Thank you so much for that.
You're great. Appreciate that.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.